Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
At this point in time, can you believe that Lee Harvey Oswald killed President John F. Kennedy by himself? Don't make your decision until you see Executive Action, possibly the most controversial motion picture of our time.
Start the target.
A film that nobody would make until now.
Fire!
Never before in American history has one family held such an enormous concentration of political power. The plan is perfectly plain. 2 terms for JFK, 2 for Bobby, and 2 for Ted.
Which makes action now imperative.
What kind of action?
Executive.
Burt Lancaster.
I'll take it from here, Bob.
Robert Ryan and Will Gear take executive action in a drama where startling fiction challenges established facts.
Probabilities for success are almost 100%.
They're like the Bay of Pigs.
Now, look, you're a high-risk man. You're on contract. Your men are all experienced in black operations. You take your chances and you get paid for it, and damn well.
A story built on long investigation and careful deduction, fitting together the missing pieces in the most important and tragic murder of our century.
So we've determined that our action can best be carried out during a motorcade.
For even though the Warren Report has officially closed the case, the baffling questions still remain.
A small army of anti-Castro Cubans are already, they're all available, and they can do anything from picking a lock and bugging an embassy to taking care of an ambassador.
All yours.
Did Cuban undercover operatives have a Dallas connection?
What's your name?
Lee Harvey Oswald.
Whether 2 Lee Harvey Oswalds.
American imperialism.
You're a spy for Castro. You came to our office of Cuban students in exile. Why don't you go to Cuba and stay there?
Are you trying to tell me people in the CIA and FBI are going to help with this project?
In the last 2 years, Secret Service has established 149 threats against Kennedy's life from Texas alone. If they send him into hostile territory with no more protection than you and I would arrange for a favorite dog.
Could one man alone assassinate John Kennedy?
One man firing from long range at a moving target is out of the question. The only possible scenario, 3 rifles with triangulated fire.
Fire.
A motion picture that must be seen by anyone who still has doubt.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me from the grassy knoll is Mr. Rob St. Mary.
You know, I think we should form a band. We could call ourselves the Lone Gunmen.
It's kind of like the Lone Rangers. This week we are talking about the 1997 film Executive Decision starring Kurt Russell.
1970. Oh, no.
This isn't the Kurt Russell movie?
No.
With Steven Seagal?
No.
Oh, I watched the wrong movie again.
Mike.
Ah, oh, jeez.
Man.
All right, instead let's talk about the 1973 film Executive Action.
There you go.
10 years after the Kennedy assassination, the film was one of the first major narratives that examined the events leading up to the November 22nd, 1963 events in Dallas, Texas. The film story was written by Mark Lane, the author of Rush to Judgment, and Donald Freed, the author of Secret Honor, which we covered last year. The screenplay was written by Dalton Trumbo, the poster child for the House on Un-American Activities Commission, and it stars Hollywood 10 actor Will Gear, who we discussed a bit on our seconds episode. Beyond that, the cast also includes Burt Lancaster and Robert Ryan in Ryan's final performance. Executive Action takes a look at the discussions that could have been between those who conspired to kill President Kennedy on that fateful day 50 years ago. So, Rob, you brought me Executive Action. I had never seen this before. Why Executive Action?
Never seen this either. I had never even heard of it, to be quite honest. And it's kind of underground. I mean, As we get into, you'll hear a little bit about how this film kind of came and went pretty quick in 1973. It came to my attention, actually, when I interviewed Donald Freed for Secret Honor, when we did that last November in honor of the presidential election. Of course, Secret Honor, the one-man stage play and then film starring Philip Baker Hall as President Nixon, disgraced President Nixon. Quite a great film if you haven't had a chance to see it. And Donald Freed had said, oh, by the way, you know, Mark Lane is a good friend of mine and we worked together on this other film. And I said, oh, that's cool. You know, and I looked it up and I was like, wow, this is a pretty amazing little film. And, you know, when I say little film, it really was. I mean, it was made for under $1 million in 1972, 73. It came out in time for the what would have been the 10th anniversary then of the Kennedy assassination in 1973. And it's a rather quick film. It's only 90 minutes long. And when I was watching it, I was having a lot of flashbacks to what Oliver Stone had done with JFK, although this is at 90 minutes, you could probably do that three times over. It would be about as long as JFK. And also, given the technology of the day that Stone was working with in terms of reenactment and the budget and things like that, you can definitely see sort of a through line between this film and what Oliver Stone did in 1990-91.
Yeah, I definitely was having very much the same feeling. Like, as I'm seeing certain scenes play out, I'm like, oh, I remember how this played out in JFK. And it was, yeah, it was really strange feeling to see these two films because I'm fairly familiar with JFK. And to see this one, I was just like, wow, it was almost like a little bit of a deja vu as it played out.
The one thing that I would say with this film that's a little bit more speculative, and there's even a title card that reads, although much of this film is fiction, much of it is based on documented historical fact. Did the conspiracy we describe actually exist? We do not know. We merely suggest that it could have existed. So that was actually like a disclaimer title card that was in the front credits of Executive Action. And I would say that Executive Action is more about, it almost feels like a stage play. If you look at it, it's usually three or four people sitting around on couches or having dinner or something, and they're just having these discussions. And what's interesting to me is that there are long sections of exposition where they're explaining certain things, but it never really gets dull. You know, most films, if you got to sit there and listen to someone talk for several minutes to explain what's going on, it has a tendency to grind the film to a halt. Now, it doesn't get boring for me because it's not about quick cuts or anything like that. It's just masterfully played, I think, by Burt Lancaster and Will Gear and Robert Ryan as well. And also the use, like I said, in terms of flashbacks with JFK, the use of actual footage, such as using newsreels and documentary footage from that day.
The film is definitely, to me, it feels like it's in two major chunks. There's the parts with Lancaster, Ryan, and Gear. And I like what you were saying as far as it never gets boring. And that's because, for me, each man has a very different point of view. They're coming to this kind of collusion from very different angles. And Gear, for the most part, at first anyway, is not buying into it 100%. And he kind of has to be convinced not only by the other men, but also by the world events that are going on.
Yeah, I'm sorry, gentlemen, I'm still unconvinced. Oh, I agree with you. The welfare of this country is worth any man's life, even the president's. My advice, for what it's worth to you, is wait.
I'll see you to your car. Harold? Harold?
Oh. Before I took over Transjordanian Oil, my own intelligence men had to eliminate a little local opposition. I understand these things. I just don't like them. They're tolerable only if they're necessary, and permissible only if they work.
And it's not just these three guys hanging out, talking, you know, over and over and over again or for long stretches, because there are little breaks where they kind of go out into the world and do their thing. You know, I'm thinking of like Gear going home and seeing some of the news footage as far as what Kennedy is up to, and then coming back and being like, okay, you know, let's do this thing. And then all of that is intercut with those kind of, you know, how the plot is coming together. And for me, that's the most fascinating part of it, is to see the way that the stories are being built, and this kind of the fake Oswalds are kind of out in the world, and just the way that everything is happening, and the way that they're doing their target practice out in the desert and all this stuff. It was, that to me was my favorite part of it, just to see how these pieces are going to fit together later on.
The real core of the discussion on this show is really going to be comparing executive action to JFK. And really, because I think, you know, JFK sort of sets the standard for any narrative film with actors that tries to get at the JFK assassination. It just does. Oliver Stone just did a masterful job with it. But there's a lot of corollary, as we were saying just a bit ago, between how this film is laid out and how that film is laid out. I think one thing that's really interesting is Stone really brings across in JFK this idea that it was probably the military, that it was CIA, that it was Bay of Pigs, that it was that stuff. In here, it seems like those people could be used in order to move this conspiracy forward. And the way in which the plotting takes place and the discussion takes place is that we get the idea, and especially with Will Gear's character, that these are businessmen who have had to do certain similar things in previous places around the world when things just didn't work out the way they should have. And it just sort of seems that with executive action, it's more about business. And as a matter of fact, the discussion seems to be sort of twofold as they're building this conspiracy. One is they see sort of these social, military, and political changes that are coming. And there's also a discussion of sort of, we're going to be in the minority soon.
2 decades, there will be 7 billion human beings on this planet. Most of them brown, yellow, or black. All of them hungry. All of them determined to love. They'll swarm out of their breeding grounds into Europe and North America. Hence Vietnam. An all-out effort there will give us control of South Asia for decades to come. And with proper planning, we can reduce the population to 550 million by the end of the century. I know. I've seen the data.
And that could be very damaging to our interests.
It's very telling to me that JFK begins with the Eisenhower leaving office and that whole discussion of the military-industrial complex.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic process.
When it comes to executive action, definitely we are looking at the industrial part of the military-industrial complex. And I think with JFK, it's more of the military end and more of, as you were saying, the CIA and this kind of shadow operation going on within the government. And as it is with executive action, it feels very shadowy. You know, it feels like these three men in a room, which is kind of what it is, three men in a room making these decisions that are going to have these huge repercussions. But it feels to me like they think that that's their right as businessmen and as men of power, that they have the right to kind of throw their weight around in this way. If we can do it, let's do it.
And you also get the feeling that it is very business. I mean, nobody in this film gets upset. There's no real emotionalism in their voice.
No.
They're like, well, this is just the way it is. You know, this has been set up. As a matter of fact, the first lines of dialogue we get in the film is someone explaining to Will Gear that basically JFK is part of a long line of succession of the Kennedy family, that basically he's the first front in.
Never before in American history has one family held such an enormous concentration of political power. The plan is perfectly plain. To retain and perpetuate this power for decades. 2 terms for JFK, 2 for Bobby, and 2 for Ted. And in each administration, the brothers who are not president would take over the most powerful cabinet posts. They have several $100 million and some of the best brains on earth to carry through. They have put together a powerful coalition of big city machines, labor, Negroes, Jews, liberals, and the press that will make him unbeatable in 1964.
And it's like, we don't do something now with all the changes that are coming, this is going to be very detrimental to us. And I think also what's interesting about executive action that sort of leads into the idea that this is about business is the title card for the film is shown over a shot of a boardroom table.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, this is business. That's all it is. And that's the idea that we get is that, you know, they're going to move in a very business manner. They're going to hire the people that they need to hire. They're going to vet these people. They're going to pick all of these various folks for the various reasons of why they're there. And I also like the aspect of what Burt Lancaster's character says about political assassinations in history.
In Europe, heads of state always die at the hands of conspirators. Our presidents are killed by madmen. The pattern is remarkably consistent.
Yeah, whether it has or hasn't. That's the story that's always sold anyway. Actually, it kind of brings up a couple movie lines I'm reminded of as far as it's not personal, it's business, you know, and that's what it is. We don't have Kevin Costner crying in this movie. We don't have anyone's voice breaking. They are so cold and so professional about it. I almost enjoy that about them because it does show just that these are the wheels and this is how things get done. And they are very calculated with the way that it happens. There's no real hatred or anything. I mean, because there are a lot of emotions that are tied up in what Kennedy was doing in the first few years of his presidency. And there were, you know, posters out there, you know, saying that he should be, you know, tried for treason and all this stuff. Of course, we always see, I mean, every president, I don't know since when, but, you know, it's like every day I'll see, like, even today I was over at, I think, Yahoo or something, and there was a big ad on the side that was like, should Obama be impeached? And I'm just like, great. Yeah. You know, how many, every president that I know of, it's like, you know, there's always a call for impeachment. There's never anybody that's, you know, happy 100% of the time. The other thing that I'm reminded of is what you're talking about with the brothers Kennedy and just that line from A Boy and His Dog where it's, the dog is reciting back the president's, or I think it might be the boy who's reciting back the president's. And it's just like, at one point it's like Kennedy, Kennedy, Kennedy. You know, it's just like, yeah, there might have been a long line there, but definitely some forces were at work to make sure that that never happened.
The film really postulates and puts forward and explains sort of this multi-gun theory, you know, mm-hmm. this multi-gunman conspiracy, that there were three people, it was triangulated and all this stuff. The Oliver Stone film kind of goes into it a little bit, but it's more about who set everything up, like who would have benefited, who would have put the whole thing together. That's really what it's about. I think also what you were talking about with executive action being very cold that way and JFK being much more emotional is that the Stone film obviously is dealing with real people. In this film, it's sort of postulated ideas of people who are businessmen as opposed to a guy who's a DA in New Orleans who's got to deal with his family and all that stuff. So there's all this sort of, you know, extra element that's there. The one thing that's interesting when you watch Executive Action, and I don't believe this came out yet by 1973 because it came out later with the Church Commission and things like that, was this was right after a similar thing had just taken place in South America with the overthrow of Allende and putting Pinochet into position in Chile, which had been done by, of course, CIA. This is all out in the open and was paid for by business interests. It was various corporations that wanted this done because they were afraid of nationalization of industry in Chile. Of course, that's nothing new. You go back to the 1950s. Why does Iran hate America so much? Well, we overthrow their people in the 1950s for oil interests. And that, of course, was done with the help of the CIA and also big business. So this idea of business and clandestine operations working hand in hand is really, it's not that far out. It actually is part of history.
And when was the Chile overthrow?
It was in the early 70s.
So. It was September 11th, 1973.
There you go.
Yeah. A little fitting timeline for you there. A little fitting anniversary. Yeah. I like that in JFK, they don't necessarily come out and say, this is how it was done. So many things are just conjecture, like talking about the positions of where the gunmen were. You know, like you said, they are very deliberate in executive action to show Texas Book Depository, Grassy Knoll, and the, what is it, the federal building right next door?
I know that it was in the Mark Lane documentary. There was actually like a guard tower or building or something that's actually behind the Grassy Knoll. But but really, I mean, anyone who's studied it says that the kill shot was the gunman on the Grassy Knoll. So
right. So yeah, they show in executive action where those three places are. And then in JFK, it's that conversation that he's having with one of – it's Garrison having a conversation with one of the guys from his law office. And he's like, you know, where would you fire your weapon from, having been in the military? He's like, well, here's one shot, here's the other one, and the other one would be over here. And it's like, you know, it's very much the whole idea of they state questions like facts. You know, it's that kind of same thing that we see a lot on like Fox News now, where, you know, I'm just asking questions. You know, I'm not making statements, I'm just asking questions. Well, those questions are very leading, very telling, and are very much just like statements, just by the way that you're asking them. And I think JFK is just kind of rife with that whole idea of postulates are facts, but they're just putting them to the audience in that way of like, well, what happened to this man? And could it have been this? And, you know, it's a little murky in some things. Not to say that I don't like JFK. I've actually seen it a lot of times. I saw it when it was at the theater probably two or three times. It was actually out when I was working at the Star Theater way back when. So I got to see it for free, and that was one I definitely took advantage of. And it gave me chills then, and it still gives me chills when I watch it today.
There are certain elements, like we talked about, in terms of structure and various things that are in both films that kind of echo both films, where at the end of JFK, there's this whole kind of like title card about how all this information is now on lockdown and it won't come out until 2029 and all of this. And at the end of executive action, one of the things that they highlight is the final title card and voiceover is about how many people died mysteriously.
In the 3 years after the murders of President Kennedy and Lee Harvey Oswald, 18 material witnesses died, 6 by gunfire, 3 in motor accidents, 2 by suicide, 1 from a cut throat, 1 from a karate chop to the neck, 3 from heart attacks, and 2 from natural causes. An actuary engaged by the London Sunday Times concluded that on November 22, 1963, the odds against these witnesses being dead by February 1967 were 100,000 trillion to 1.
You know, what does that say? Maybe there was something more than what the Warren Commission wanted you to accept.
Yeah, what was it, 100,000 trillion to 1 that these 18 people would have all died within this period of time?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then the one thing that's in this film that isn't in JFK, at least from what I remember, is the talk on why Oswald was picked. There's a lot of stuff in here. There's like a whole section that goes on for about 5 minutes. It's almost like a slideshow presentation in which in executive action where they go, okay, well, why Oswald? Why this guy? Well, here's why. And look at all these odd things about him. Like, how did this happen? And how did this happen? And how was he able to, you know, get that visa so fast when no one can get the visa that fast? And so there was all these various things about them setting it up, you know, the conspirators. And then also they're the ones, there's also a discussion about Jack Ruby and how he was this cleanup man who was sent in to make sure that no one talked, specifically Oswald, since he was killed 2 days later.
Yeah, and that whole thing, I'm glad they go into the idea of the notes that were being taken and then destroyed. In JFK, I like that they were doing that. And then I do like that executive action doesn't stop with the assassination of Kennedy, because obviously you have, you know, in traditional filmmaking, that would be the end of the third act, or it could be. But I like that it's really kind of more the second act, and then the third act is that time afterwards between Kennedy being killed and Oswald being killed. You know, we talk about how these two films are kind of, you know, very similar in the way. I mean, obviously they're telling kind of the same story. It's that whole idea of, you know, reinterpretation. It's sorcerer versus wages of fear, right? And that kind of really comes up time and again when you're talking about the idea of John F. Kennedy. I mean, I remember when I was a younger man that on TV, I think it was on Showtime, they had this big event about the trial of Lee Harvey Oswald. And they played this, and it was like a long, you know, like a mini series kind of thing. And then looking it up recently to see about, you know, seeing it again, I found that there were actually three trials of Lee Harvey Oswald. There's one in 64, one in 86, and one in 77. So it's like every single decade had their trial of Lee Harvey Oswald. And then I guess you could kind of say that JFK in 1991 was a little bit of that, though it was the trial of Clay Shaw instead of Oswald. But still, we've got this kind of trial motif looking to uncover the answers that we're, you know, digging for so much. And that's the other thing about JFK that always cracks me up is that, you know, the way that that movie is paced, you know, I watched it the other day again, and I was like an hour and 50 minutes into it, something like that. And I was like, gosh, they haven't even arrested Clay Shaw yet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And then finally they do, and they get it to the trial, and they talk a little bit about Mr. Shaw. And then really, it's like so much of the trial, quote unquote, are the closing arguments. And I always forget that it's the closing arguments, because I'm like, dude, are you ever going to like get back to Shaw? Because you're just talking about all this other stuff. It was like this open forum for Garrison in the film, at least. And I don't know how it was in real life. But just for him to be like, and another thing, what about that bullet? And I was like, okay, geez, I wanted to be like, relevance, Your Honor.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's basically just an excuse for Kevin Costner to have like a 35-minute monologue. I mean, it's yeah.
But someday, somewhere, someone may find out the damn truth. We better. We better, or we might just as well build ourselves another government. Like the Declaration of Independence says to when the old one ain't working, just a little farther out west. An American naturalist wrote, a patriot must always be ready to defend his country against its government. I'd hate to be in your shoes today. You have a lot to think about. You've seen much hidden evidence the American public has never seen. You know, going back to when we were children, I think that most of us in this courtroom thought that justice came into being automatically, that virtue was its own reward, that good would triumph over evil. But as we get older, we know this just isn't true. Individual human beings have to create justice, and this is not easy. Because the truth often poses a threat to power, and one often has to fight power at great risk to themselves.
Going to JFK, and I guess we want to get into it because we've already brought it up somewhat, and we'll talk a little bit more about it later, is that to me, JFK is interesting because there's a lot of things that I like about it. I mean, I saw it in the theater when it came out. It was only like, I think it came out in 90, so I was probably 12. I think it was the same summer that Malcolm X came out. I saw them both. And around the same time, big epic, you know, 3 hour plus movies. And I remember watching it then. I don't think I got everything, obviously. And I hadn't seen it except in pieces over the years. And I got it out of the library and I watched the director's cut, which I think is like an extra 30 minutes. So it's like, it's like 320 or something like this. And the one thing that I commented on as I was watching it was, the characters, like the characterization and the acting is so over the top. It is so like camp value, but it seems to work. Like I was just like, man, these guys are just chewing the scenery and over the top. But for some reason it works for me in terms of the characterizations and the acting. The other thing that I found fascinating about JFK, just from a construction aspect, just like with everything that's in it, you know, reenactments, multi-format, black and white and color, newsreel footage, like all of that stuff. To me, it's the blueprint for a film that I absolutely love by Oliver Stone a few years later, and that's Natural Born Killers. I think that if it wasn't for JFK, Natural Born Killers probably wouldn't have been as good as it was in terms of the use of multi-format.
Yeah, that editing style, the pace of it, the use of the black and white versus the color, the different film stocks, all that was just, Just beautiful the way that he put that together. And really, I mean, it was kind of this MTV editing style that was talked about so much in the 80s, but really brought to the fore. I mean, I can't really think of another American mainstream, and this was mainstream. This was open at, you know, regular movie theaters, even though it was long and about kind of a, you know, subject that not a, a lot of people wanted to hear about. But mainstream film, I can't really think of anything else that exemplified this multimedia style better than JFK. And then, you know, years later, since then, I should say, since 91 when this came out, it's been copied so many times. I mean, by Stone himself, but then, yeah, so many other filmmakers really kind of took that ball and ran with it. And it's really kind of a nice way. I mean, I think that the multi-format and this quick cutting stuff really works well to tell the story, just because there are so many pieces and so many perspectives. You know, we've talked about movies that have multi-perspectives before, and this one kind of brings that all to it, just with the use of, are we showing this in black and white? Are we showing it on, you know, what looks like 8mm on 16? You know, is it crisp? Is it not? Is it overblown? You know, what's the lighting style? Each one of these seems to be, you know, a different voice kind of leading us through the story, which I really appreciate with this one.
Yeah.
And you're right, as far as the camp value goes. I mean, John Candy, oh my God. And then
it's just this side. I mean, John Candy in there, it's just this side of SCTV. I mean, stuff he would do on there.
Pop the Bimbo in red. Mm-hmm. Lordy.
Yeah, she's cute all right, but not half as cute as you, Dino.
Thank you.
You should try a legitimate line of business.
Why are you dancing on my head for, my man? We've been thick as molasses pie since law school.
Keep conning me, Dean. I read your testimony to the Warren Commission.
There you go again.
Joe Pesci is over the top. I mean, you haven't he's like, he's basically
a clown. He amuses me.
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, the stuff that he does in Casino, which I think is overacting at times, is like if you took his character in Casino and blended it with a gay man, that's what you get.
Black, just give it to me. Black. Shit, my neck is killing me. I got cancer I've had it for years. I've been working with Mike, you know, trying to find a cure.
Did you ever work for the CIA?
You make it sound like some remote fucking experience in ancient history. Man, you don't leave the agency. Once you're in, they got you for life.
Shaw?
Shaw's an untouchable. Highest clearance. Shaw, Oswald, the Cubans, all agency.
About Ruby?
Jack was a pimp. He was a bagman for the Dallas mob. He used to run guns to Castro when he was still on our side.
This is like Lethal Weapon style acting from Pesci. Oh, yeah. This is kind of the reason why people go, whatever happened to Joe Pesci? I mean, But you're right, though. It worked with the character, you know, that manic intensity and everything worked with the character.
Well, not only that, but for some reason, I think the reason why it works for me is when you watch interviews of people from that era, there's a certain mannerism, I think, of like, and we'll talk more about this. I know this is an odd segue, but we'll talk more about this when we talk about Magnificent Ambersons in a few weeks. But there seems to be a certain mannerism or style of people during this era, you know? And in some way, this sort of overacting, or it's this over-enunciation, or there's something about the way it's played that lends an authenticity to it, even though it's so overblown. I know that that doesn't make any sense, but it's kind of like when you consider back during that era, or even, you know, a little earlier, in terms of dress, like, you know, men wore shirts and suits and hats and things like that. And now we walk around in t-shirts and jeans all the time. So there's a certain formality in some way, but it's like an over the top formality that just seems to work. I don't know how they figured this out, you know, but it just works for me, even though at times it seems like people are eating the scenery, especially Kevin Costner. There are certain notes that he hits in his performance that just kind of thud for me, and I have to laugh. But overall, I think he does a nice job.
It cracks me up how high in the credits Kevin Bacon's character is. I mean, the guy is barely in the film, but he managed to get, like, I don't want to say, like, for sure third billing, but he's pretty darn high up there.
And he had a good agent.
Yeah, he must have, man. Kudos to Kevin Bacon. And I have to say, when it comes to the whole 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon game, this movie is like the linchpin, man. You do not get better than JFK, because there are so many people in here, old Hollywood and new Hollywood, between Walter Matthau, Jack Lemmon, and Ed Asner as old Hollywood, and then D'Onofrio and Oldman, you know, as new Hollywood. It's just like, you are set, man. If you can tie somebody back to anybody in JFK, you're right there with the Kevin Bacon connection.
And then you've got like 1970s with Donald Sutherland, so there you go.
Exactly. So, yeah, and Sutherland making that great kind of cameo appearance and just taking the film kind of off the rails for a few minutes, but leading you into some really interesting territory before you kind of come back to it.
So Executive Action, Oliver Stone has said that Executive Action was an influence on him. There's an interview that I saw that was posted a few years ago on YouTube where Stone interviews Mark Lane about Rush to Judgment. So Stone knew about this film. He knew about Mark Lane's work, because obviously if you're reading all that stuff that he did in order to build that film, he would definitely be in the know on all of this stuff related to the work that Mark Lane had done.
Yeah, Executive Action is like a primer for the Kennedy conspiracy and for JFK. I mean, it's like if you don't want to spend the 3 hours watching JFK, you can watch Executive Action instead, because you're going to get very much the same story, just kind of told in a different way, and not with the multimedia. I mean, if those quick cuts bother you, that's fine. Go back to Executive Action, because you even get, like, I like the way that they do the two scenes to me that are so similar are the construction of the picture of Oswald that was used on the Life magazine cover.
Yeah, there's that, and then also the auto dealership.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and the target practice thing. I was like, is that Frank Whaley in Executive Action? Oh, no, no. He wasn't even born yet, I'm sure. But yeah, there it was. Yeah, that's when I was watching the film and I put on my Facebook page. I was like, I'd like to take all of these Kennedy films and just cut them together into one massive, you know, death of JFK kind of thing, because really you could substitute some of those scenes one right for another and it would work.
Especially that auto dealership piece where one of the Oswalds that was seen around town goes to the auto dealer and gives the guy a hard time.
I like that, and I like the scene of the guy watching the film or the telecine of Oswald on TV, and he's trying to pick up his speaking patterns and stuff. I thought that was pretty fascinating, too. Let's go ahead and take a break and hear an interview with Donald Freed. He wrote the story with attorney Mark Lane for Executive Action.
There are 12 miles of bad road, and now they have a microphone and their own show. It's the Daily Grindhouse Podcast, the official podcast of DailyGrindhouse.com. Starring G.
You tell her that you sent you here. How sorry I am, I can no longer be her friend.
And the man called Perry.
I'm the one that killed Munden, whooped Tuesday, put Wims in the hospital. Called up Thursday to tell Bob did not the Burrs, Sarah Jones' son.
Reviewing the hits and the hidden from the world of exploitation, cinema, and beyond. Featuring exclusive cast and crew interviews. Past guests include John Carpenter, Robert Forster, Brian Trenchard-Smith, but still no Steve Guttenberg. we'll get him someday. We promise. I mean, we promise. The Daily Grindhouse Podcast, available on iTunes, Stitcher Smart Radio, Podomatic, and of course at dailygrindhouse.com/podcasts. The Daily Grindhouse Podcast, tough films for the rough crowd.
Got the goddamn message? Let's go to work.
Hey, it's Rob St. Mary from the Projection Booth. And, you know, I want to tell you about a guy, kind of humble guy, I guess, my podcast partner. That's right, he has a new book out. His name's Mike White, and it's called Cinema Detours. The guy's so humble, he won't even bring it up on the show. I don't know what that's all about. But anyway, just want to say Cinema Detours got a chance to take a look at it, read through it. And it's kind of fun. I mean, you have these reviews for movies that you've probably seen before. And it's like chatting with an old friend. And then there's the movies that you haven't seen, which you got to add to your list and hopefully get to see before you die. Thanks a lot, Mike, for telling me about all these movies that I got to see now. But really, ultimately, why I'm coming to you about why you should pick up Cinema Detours either at Amazon.com or for your Kindle, or you can go over to projection-booth.com and pick it up as well, is because, you see, Mike's wife told me to do this. You might not know this, but Mike has 37 children, and he needs the money in order to take care of them. 37 kids, can you imagine? So Cinema Detours, projection-booth.com. You can also get it at Amazon, either in paper form or for your Kindle. So check it out. It's Mike White, Cinema Detours, and now I know why I don't get paid for this podcast.
This is Adam Spiegelman from the cult movie podcast Proudly Resents, and you listen to my favorite movie podcast, The Projection Booth. I know, it's messed up, right?
Excuse me, what are you doing? Are you looking for porn again?
No.
Well, what is that I see?
It's not porn. It's the badassboobsandbodycounts.com website. I happen to be looking at the reviews in the boobs section of the site.
They have a section of the site dedicated to boobs?
Yes, they do. They cover exploitation films in the boobs category, action films in the badass category, and horror in the body counts category.
And what's that other option, BBNBC podcast?
If you're not into reading the reviews, you can listen to them via the web on your mobile device through iTunes, and they cover the same types of films, lesser known action, exploitation, and horror cinema. So yeah, to answer your question, I wasn't cruising porn.
That's too bad.
What's too bad?
That you weren't cruising for porn.
Why?
Because I was feeling kind of horny.
Oh, wait, get back here. Hey, get back here.
You know, I was looking for a little excitement, but I was worried about privacy. And then I found out about vibrators.com. Vibrators.com has the perfect products for women and men and couples. They have helpful suggestions and information on how to make sure you get something just right for you. Plus, for over a decade, Vibrators.com has never played around with your privacy. While other.coms make their money by selling your information, Vibrators.com never has and never will. And when you use the special code BOOTH, that's B-O-O-T-H, at checkout, you'll receive free priority shipping on any order. That's vibrators.com. Get a little excitement in your life.
All right, I'm here with Bill Byforce and Mr. Chris to tell you a little bit about Outside the Cinema.
All right, Reverend Scott, take us to church.
What can we expect to find from a typical show?
2 hours of just random blabber.
Is there anyone's coattails you rode in on to popularity?
I'm the guy that fucking burns the coattails and then pisses on them.
You review all these exploitation, horror, comedy, cult, and often all-around terrible movies. You must have a strong driving force that keeps you going.
Ego.
I don't know if I've heard you say that before.
Yeah, I've been saying that for a while.
Really?
I have been saying that for a while. Also, I'm high on smack.
Well, it's definitely working for you guys. People are coming out in droves to support you on iTunes.
We just the other day got a one-star review on iTunes.
Well, that is one star too many. Let me tell you, the worst fucking piece of shit I've ever heard.
This has been great, guys.
Thanks, Scott. That was good. Oh, he's got you crying over there.
I'm good for the rest of the year.
Nice.
That was too much.
Where were you when Kennedy was killed?
I was in a classroom in the State University in, outside of Los Angeles. I was taking some classes long after I had been to the university, but I was filling in some classes of interest to me in theater and English. And I was at... you're just coming into a class, then followed it on the radio and TV and so on.
What was your first thoughts when you heard that news as it unfolded?
Well, I never questioned. I just followed it as it, you know, the news was one step behind events, and then I followed one step behind the news, so I had sort of canned information over the formative period when decisions are usually made and preliminary conclusions come to. And I was involved in a large project of transforming Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment to the stage, and that took up most of my time all that year. And in fact, I even used a quotation from Nietzsche about the pale criminal in the crowd, which at that time echoed the understanding of the public of a one lone psychopath, Lee Harvey Oswald. So I was not, and I'm not. I am not quick to jump to alternate conspiracy theories. I just didn't. Register with me. So it was about a year later when I was reading the New York Review of Books, and Professor Richard Popkin, the noted historian, was reviewing a book. The various books and early writings by Mark Lane and others, Rush to Judgment, about the murder in Dallas. And as I read that long review, with new information supplied by Professor Popkin, and the thesis of it was that there were several people using the name Lee Harvey Oswald. And these facts were easily proved because the FBI, there were documents from the FBI about someone using the name Lee Harvey Oswald. There were also reports from Dallas of Lee Harvey Oswald at a firing range and Lee Harvey Oswald driving a car. Well, Lee Harvey Oswald did not drive. So there were about three Oswalds in this recorded, and these are simple pedestrian kinds of facts. This is not based on ballistics or physics or acoustics, etc. So that struck me. It simply struck me. And then there was a mention, either in that article, in that book review, or soon after, about, it must have been soon after, in the next period of time, about the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, with which Lee Harvey Oswald was identified in New Orleans. And the information being that it was a front, a paper committee. It was only one member, and that was Lee Harvey Oswald. He used another name, the name Alex Heidel. But, and so that was notable. But then what stopped me in my tracks, so to speak, was that the according to official reports, the address of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, the pro-Castro, pro-communist committee, which this seemed to be a dummy example or a dummy or a front, this address on Lafayette Street in New Orleans, which is neither here nor there, until I learned from reading this, and then I've lived in New Orleans, and I'm from Louisiana, and part of my life, and I was soon able to look further into this. The building is at Camp and Lafayette, so the Warren Commission and the official reportage of the Fair Play for the communist origins of Lee Harvey Oswald, although he was considered now publicly a lone nut, still originally there had been the beginnings of a sort of communist jacket put on him because he had been a defector, so-called, to the Soviet Union. But his office, this phony office, was listed, the address, correctly on Lafayette. But what wasn't listed or mentioned publicly in the press, and they had to have known, was that that building has another address on Camp Street. It's on Camp and Lafayette. And adjacent to Lee Harvey Oswald's Fair Play for Cuba Committee, and actually sharing space, was a notorious CIA front, the Anti-Communist League of the Caribbean, headed up by a rabid right-wing organizer who had been a special agent in charge in the Chicago office of the FBI some years earlier. And it's from that office and other fronts that the Lake Pontchartrain-trained paramilitary operations and organizations were centered. And that those lesser known, but they are concomitant with the Florida bases, CIA bases, all in preparation for the Bay of Pigs. And after the Bay of Pigs, when the CIA had been humiliated and President Kennedy had taken responsibility for the failure of the of the operation, which he had reluctantly taken over from Mr. Nixon and President Eisenhower, that CIA and the former Alan Dulles had been fired, E. Howard Hunt had been fired, the top middle level of the clandestine section had been fired by John Kennedy. He did that with the one hand he took responsibility, and with the other hand he lowered the boom on the CIA. And he it was reported that he and his brother had come to the conclusion that the CIA had to be, as it was then known, had to be taken apart. But that was for the future. This base continued in Lake Pontchartrain to train. The FBI was sent in by the White House, and there were gunpoint confrontations. This was all unreported and unique in American history. But this is at the same time that Kennedy was trying to turn off the secret war against Castro. The Treasury Department was moving on guns and on counterfeit money. The Coast Guard was trying to stop rogue operations going out from Miami. Kennedy was using everything he could from the executive branch, but he was losing the war, this intelligence war going on behind the scenes. And although he and his brother had originated these operations, and so they had a great deal of difficulty to turn dramatically, as they were attempting to do, and they were behind the scenes. This activity by the Kennedy brothers, together with the failure to send in the flag and an armada or flotilla to back up the Cuban volunteers who were working for the CIA and landing on the beach at Playa Girón. We know from reports from E. Howard Hunt and others who were at Langley, and they were talking into the night to the White House. They were demanding, they were begging, they were pleading for support from the White House, because they had promised their battalions that if for any reason there was not a spontaneous uprising, as they confidently predicted, I think cynically, obviously, not to worry, no problem, Castro's hated, there'll be an uprising immediately, and if not, don't worry, we'll send in the flag, you will never be abandoned. Well, they were abandoned. Kennedy learned his lesson, but he learned it just a half step late, but he learned it, and he refused to send in the flag. And he refused to take that step which might have led to a Russian, a Soviet countermeasure. And they said they were drunk at Langley, Hunt and the others, drinking through the night and punching their fists through walls, beside themselves with rage, fury, impotence, humiliation, and no way to face all the men being arrested on the beach. Absolute disaster, and they had promised and given their word and spoken for the American government, and now this new president, this Kennedy, this untried within the first 90 days, of his administration, and he was saying no, and he would not do it. And it was clear, and I'm outlining steps now that in the next year or so, I could not help but notice as information came out, Kennedy was, the hatred for Castro was programmatic, political, diplomatic, institutional. The hatred for Kennedy was visceral, almost psychopathic because of this. And there were many people who did not like President Kennedy for many other reasons, some of them rational, some of them irrational, some of them religious, and so forth, just as you have in the Obama situation and you had in the Clinton situation. But it was Kennedy's, the hatred towards Kennedy was not quite what it was against Roosevelt at first, but it built to that. So the idea that Fair Play for Cuba Committee, the pro-Castro, apparat could share office space with the anti-Castro, anti-Communist League of the Caribbean, the CIA front in New Orleans, was beyond, it was an insult to the intelligence. And Jim Garrison, who was in New Orleans and who later based his work, his strongest work, he did not have the range and the freedom to make arrests or put people under oath, as the government would have, but he knew New Orleans all right, and he was able to show that in that area, in that very area around Oswald's office, you had the Office of Naval Intelligence, you have the FBI, you have CIA fronts, you had the Trade Center in New Orleans, which is where Clay Shaw, who was an operative of the Central Intelligence Agency, but not high-ranking, was as high as District Attorney Garrison could go, but it wasn't high enough to win a jury verdict. But Oliver Stone in his film, I think, basically, you can learn just about everything you need to learn from that film, although there's one shadowy scene where Lyndon Johnson seems to be doing something or other that looks nefarious, but which doesn't add to the film, and I don't think is true at all, frankly. So little by little, I came to the conclusion that it was just inescapable. Then I began to learn some of the details. I met Mark Lane. I had a play opening on Broadway on the Rosenberg case, and then we discussed the JFK. And because the Rosenberg case, the atom bomb spy trials from the early 1950s, which had been, you just could not say anything about it, and you could not publish anything, and it was heavy political censorship. But that was changing, and the tryout of the Cleveland Playhouse of the play had brought a Broadway producer. And so it wasn't particularly my prophetic courage of any kind. The time, I was just lucky. There was a window of opportunity then. But I could see that that window could be expanded, and so Mark Lane, who had written Rush to Judgment and who had been turned down by every single publisher in the United States, and again, there were four different times when it had been accepted, and then the publishers had come back to them and said they'd been visited by the FBI. So he had to go to England, and there Lord Bertrand Russell intervened, and the book was published, and it became one of the worldwide bestsellers of the 20th century. So Mark Lane, who in his book, A Citizen's Descent, details all this, and it's great reading, just as Rush to Judgment is, necessary reading, obligatory, I think. And so Mark certainly was interested, very much so, and took the lead, and it was his research, basically, that was used in the book. And then the film was made, and the film was watered down somewhat, but still, it was it broke the ice. It helped inspire Oliver Stone, according to Oliver, but it had handicaps. The major networks would not take advertising for it. The ads that were censored were simply newsreel photographs of the motorcade in Dealey Plaza. That was it. They rejected those advertisements as being too violent. So there was no major publicity. Yet the film, which was made for a shoestring, and thanks to Burt Lancaster's Robert Ryan and Will Gear, but especially Burt Lancaster, working for nothing for scale, it was released and compromised slightly, though it was, showing a little fear around the edges. It was important, and it made a great deal of money, by the way, not for me or Mark, but for the producers and inadvertently for Burt Lancaster, because he had done it for nothing but had a percentage, which wasn't thought to mean anything, but it did eventually. And of course, it had the imprimatur of the great Dalton Trumbo as the.
We're sorry, but we've run out of time. Be sure to listen to the rest of this episode at jackaloperadio.com in the Projection Booth archives. And be sure to leave your feedback at projection-booth.com. Stay classy.